I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for June 26th. The tense back and forth between U.S. and Iranian officials could end up having very real consequences.
Some of us basically fear that we're going to end up having a situation where some 5,000 years of culture comes under attack and just becomes complete rubble.
Today, two Iranian Americans discuss the personal toll of the dissolving diplomacy between the U.S. and Iran. Also on the show, a look at the policies pushing migrants to endanger their lives by crossing the Rio Grande.
Mexico has turned into the wall. Migrants in Mexico are now terrified of being deported because they cannot transit the country without papers, and most of these people do not have papers.
And we continue our week-long series, Life After Overdose. Today, how an overdose impacts the families of people struggling with addiction. It's a tough Wednesday, but we need to talk about these stories, everyone. Let's get started with Iran. Growing up, Mana Karazi often felt pulled between Iran, the place she was born, and the United States, where she's lived since she was a toddler.
It was this feeling of constantly loving these two identities and cultures that felt very naturally a part of me and a part of my identity, and yet getting these messages, whether it was from my teachers or parents of friends or, you know, just in the media, that somehow being Iranian was really bad.
The past few months have been particularly difficult for Karazi and other Iranian Americans as tensions have escalated between the U.S. and Iran.
It'll be obliteration like you've never seen before, but I'm not looking to do that.
The U.S. has been ramping up even more sanctions, and a disagreement over a downed U.S. drone almost led to a retaliatory strike by the Americans.
For those of us who grew up in the States, it's this idea of growing up and building our identity in a country that's constantly at risk of war or with increased tensions with this other place that we love and have so much family too.
Yves Mafrandereski came to the U.S. in 1971 as a college student, and he says the current uncertainty between Iran and the U.S. is worrisome.
The range of emotions that Iranians feel, both inside Iran and outside, you know, goes somewhere between complete indifference and like, what else is new? On the other hand, some of us basically fear that through some miscalculated action by one party or the other, we're going to end up having a situation where some 5,000 years of culture and territorial existence of a country comes under attack and just becomes complete rubble.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll hear more from Karazi and Mufendereski in a few minutes. But first, we turn to Farnaz Fasihi for an update on the current situation between Iran and the U.S. Farnaz writes about Iran for The New York Times. Great to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me back.
So we've been hearing so much about the back and forth between Iran and the U.S. Where do things stand today?
In the past few weeks, we've seen tensions escalate to a place where we were at the brink of war last week, where President Trump said that he had ordered a targeted attack on Iran in response to Iran's Revolutionary Guards downing over $100 million spy drone. And then he reversed that track. The U.S.'s policy seems to go back and forth between threatening, the president tweeted yesterday that he would obliterate Iran if it attacked another American target, and Iran saying that we will defend ourselves, that this is going to be very costly for America. So we have this kind of heated exchange, but at the same time, the U.S. saying that we really want to negotiate with Iran. And Mr. Trump saying that this can all go away if Iran comes to the negotiating table to talk about its nuclear deal, to talk about its missiles program and its regional policies. From Iran's perspective, they've also rejected any idea of speaking to the U.S. Today, the latest is that Ayatollah Khamenei, in response to Washington sanctioning him directly, said that the offer from the United States to negotiate is a trick, and the U.S. is afraid of our powers, and we would never negotiate with them. So this is kind of where we stand. Holding pattern, dangerously close to a conflict, and unpredictable reactions, really, from both sides.
We spoke to an Iranian-American yesterday about how they were feeling about the rhetoric. And I'm wondering, one of the things that they described was, particularly in response to President Trump's announcement and then pullback of the strike on Iran, is that it felt like psychological warfare. Farnaz, both sides are ramping up the rhetoric. Is it rhetoric or are we really expecting a conflict at this point?
Just judging by what transpired in Washington, if indeed Mr. Trump ordered attack and then he reversed 10 minutes before, as he says, because generals at the Pentagon warned him that this will be a very costly war, I think despite the rhetoric, there are in both places voices and policymakers who understand the real risk of a conflict between Iran and the U.S. We also see from Iran's side that they say we will defend ourselves, but we don't really want war. So both sides are have a subtitle of we don't really want war as the rhetoric escalates, because a war with Iran would likely involve not just Iran and the U.S., but Iran's proxies, the Shia militia Iran has trained in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, U.S. bases over there, and perhaps even either U.S. European allies or regional allies like Saudi Arabia. It would set a flame to a region that's already in chaos and potentially even destabilize oil prices and shipping insurance prices that go through the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf.
The U.S. strategy with Iran, as you mentioned earlier, feels somewhat disjointed. The U.S. is saying they want to continue negotiations with Iran, but they're also implementing sanctions. And Iran, I'm wondering if they have a cohesive strategy when it comes to the United States.
Iran does not have a cohesive strategy in that there are multiple layers of power in Iran. There's the supreme leader, which has rejected any negotiations with the U.S. There's the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who's in favor of negotiations. There's the Revolutionary Guards, which operate semi-autonomously, definitely autonomously from the elected government, but in coordination with the supreme leader. So because there is no coherent power structure, there's no one power. Unlike North Korea, where Kim Jong-un has his hand and dictates power, in Iran, there are multiple voices and multiple layers of power. And this makes the situation even more fluid in terms of its response to the U.S.
There are some who have said that, particularly in light of the president's announcement and then pullback of potential strikes on Iran, that they're feeling somewhat of a deja vu to the beginnings of the Iraq War more than a decade ago. Are you seeing that?
I covered the Iraq War, the invasion, the context, that what was happening before. Yes, it does remind, I think, reporters and analysts who were engaged with the Iraq War of the same thing, in that the U.S. is really trying to build a case why Iran is really dangerous, why Iran needs to be contained. We've seen op-eds that Iran has ties to Al-Qaeda. We've seen opposition voices attacking American scholars, journalists, anybody who's opposed to war. On U.S. tax dollar, I don't know if you followed the whole Iran disinfo scandal, where actually State Department tax dollars were used by an entity called Iran Disinfo to attack Americans. So there's a lot of echoes of the Iraq War, but I actually think that's not a bad thing. That awareness is perhaps also helping accountability and raising questions so, the U.S. doesn't recklessly enter another war and get trapped for several more decades in the Middle East and spend trillions of dollars again without much results.
Farnaz Fasihi writes about Iran for the New York Times. Farnaz, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
As tensions between the U.S. and Iran continue to escalate, we return to the stories of Yves Mufrendereski and Mana Karazi, two Iranian-Americans who came to the United States in the 70s and 80s. And they told me what it's like to live that duality today and to have your heart and your family in two countries.
I arrived in the United States in 1971 to attend Georgetown University. And when I arrived first in New York and later into Washington, D.C., it was a complete culture shock in terms of not only the physicality of the United States, but also the abundance of all sorts of amenities and the freedom that we all enjoyed in, that's very common to what our perception is of the United States. So that was those were the good times.
And can you tell our listeners what Iran was like in 1971?
Extremely hopeful. The oil exports had become a mainstay of the Iranian economy. There was progress in every direction, particularly in some social and cultural areas, women's rights and rights of workers and so on. And so the drumbeat to the future was one of attaining greater economic prosperity and one day hopefully greater political freedoms. And that coming out of the chaos of the 1950s, the post-war period, was pretty, you know, kind of hopeful times for the country. And we were on the march.
And Mana, what about you? When did you come to the United States and what prompted your journey?
My family came to the United States near the end of 1986, and I was a toddler at the time. I was born at the height of the Iran-Iraq War, and my dad actually was in the military under the Shah, so he had to leave. My family had already experienced the revolution and the trauma of the revolution and war, and I think that was when the largest population of Iranians left Iran, but it was really because of the conflict and, you know, the lack of clarity of what the future of the country would be.
What was the reception that you got when you arrived in the United States and people heard you were from Iran?
It was kind of mixed. At the one end of the spectrum, it was one of extreme hospitality. It's great. And people who had known Iran, who had traveled to Iran, and there have been enormous amount of exchanges back and forth between the Americans and Iranians in all line of work. And then there were, you know, people who always conflated the Iranians with the Arabs, and you know, we were called, you know, certain names, and which I don't deign repeating. And so it was kind of mixed, but overall I think it was extremely positive.
And Mana, what about you, having essentially come here as a toddler and growing up in the United States? What was your experience like when people would find out that you were from Iran and your family was Iranian?
Though I don't remember the 80s, I know that my parents and my siblings' experience definitely affected me, and I kind of grew up with their trauma and their baggage. So I remember, you know, like being at grocery stores or different places and my mom saying, don't tell anyone we're Iranian, or let's not speak Farsi in public, and having a lot of fear, I think, because of their experience after the hostage crisis and in the 80s at the height of the anti-Iranian sentiment. I'm the first in my family to grow up Iranian American and to really kind of have to define that identity for myself. And it was this feeling of constantly loving these two identities and cultures that felt very naturally a part of me and a part of my identity, and yet getting these messages, whether it was from my teachers or parents of friends or, you know, just in the media, that somehow being Iranian was really bad. I remember being in kindergarten and having my teacher actually tell me about the movie Not Without My Daughter, and that being my first lens into what people in the United States must think of my birth country.
I want to pivot a moment to more recent developments in the Iranian-United States relationship, Mana. After the Iran nuclear deal was passed, what was the reaction that you had and perhaps other Iranians that you know? Was it seen as a positive thing, negative thing?
I think for the majority, it was a moment of celebration and hope that somehow there would be more connections, less barriers between us and our families that we had that were still in Iran. And I think for a lot of our families in Iran, it was this moment of, okay, there's an opportunity for reform. There's going to be some economic growth. We can really change things. But there was a really beautiful period of time where I think we all were hopeful that things would shift and that Iranians within Iran would finally have an opportunity, have their own voice and not have others speak for them.
And of course, the Trump administration has since pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal. Geev, when you heard that news, what was your reaction and the reaction perhaps of other Iranians that you know?
As an attorney, and someone who believes in the sanctity of contracts, I was kind of baffled that a country who would just rip up an international agreement and say, well, we're going to take our ball and go home. And that to me was extremely disappointing from a practical standpoint as an attorney. As an American of Iranian descent, I just didn't think that that was going to be a very constructive way for the eventual rapprochement and normalization of relations between these two countries. And I was extremely disappointed. And come to think of it, maybe that 2015 nuclear deal just generated false hopes too. It's very extremely disappointing.
Mana, what are your thoughts on that?
With the agreement, we had this hope that there was an opportunity and that things were going to change. But now we're just as vulnerable to the threat of war, if not more, than ever in my lifetime. And it's become cyclical, where my community is just regularly on the political chopping block, and we're so vulnerable. When I mentioned something about fearing the risk of war, Iranians in Iran quickly remind me that they're already experiencing economic war through the sanctions. And I think for those of us who grew up in the States, it's this idea of growing up and building our identity in a country that's constantly at risk of war or with increased tensions with this other place that we love and have so much family too.
You said that the economic sanctions are almost like an economic war. I'm wondering, Giv and Mana, what you're hearing from people who are still in Iran, whether they're friends or family, about how these sanctions are impacting their everyday lives.
You know, I think they're watching their currency depreciate on a regular basis. And I think those of us outside of the country are really fearful of war, and particularly in the last week or two have been really scared about it. But in Iran, they're just trying to continue to live their lives, because the truth is they've constantly been either through war or the threat of war. And this economic war is really devastating them. They're exhausted. They're watching shortages of various medications, and those of them who are more vulnerable to illness or have any sort of vulnerability as a human being in that country are particularly at risk right now, whether it's trying to get their diabetic or blood pressure medication or even complicated medications for cancer. They're in particular really at risk, but I think everyone's just exhausted and trying to survive and trying to live with this continued threat.
I guess a big question now is, given the current administration and even what we just heard last week about President Trump saying supposedly that he had called off a drone attack right before it was set to take place, the details on that are still emerging, to within a period of 24 hours to go from that to calling it off. What is the psychological and emotional impact of that, both for you all here in the United States and friends and family who are still in Iran? I mean, the dust doesn't appear to be settling, at least not at this point.
Well, it's huge. You don't know anymore what is the truth. And this whole thing about the drone strike and then the downing of the drone and the launching of military, operations against Iran, all of this basically being put out there and then pulled back. And it creates more than just anxiety. I mean, it puts you in a place where the only way you can cope with this is to disassociate yourself from reality and go about doing your daily business. You're constantly living with this fear of anticipation, and then nothing happens, and then something happens. This may be fun and games for someone who's sitting there in the White House and thinking this is the way they're going to have to interface with the world. But for the rest of us who get affected on a daily basis with this kind of stuff, this is not fun. This really isn't fun.
Yeah, I honestly feel like I haven't been able to catch my breath since Thursday. And I think that a lot of people in the U.S. in particular feel that way. I think for Iranians in Iran, for them, it's like, what's new? Like, we've always had this threat. I spent this weekend thinking about, my family is banned from coming to this country. They're experiencing sanctions. Now they're experiencing the threat of strikes. And there's nothing I can do. I'm an American citizen, and I have very little power in being able to do anything about this. And I spent the weekend thinking about, you know, like, if there were strikes on Thursday, like, is my family ready to leave? Can they get visas to go anywhere else? How many can I actually save? And the answer is, you know, very little. Because even the family that I do have that lives in Iran, like, their currency is depreciating at a rate where it's not really worth very much anymore for them to be able to even sustainably leave. And the idea that there could potentially be, you know, a huge influx of refugees from Iran if something were to happen, and all of us sitting in this country feeling complicit in a war we don't want. How do you live on a daily basis knowing that there's a possibility that your family is going to be attacked, that you have no way of being able to help them? You know, like, am I going to, for the rest of this administration, have to try to bring it up at dinner parties? Can I just randomly bring it up in conversation and say, hey, by the way, I'm Iranian. There's a possibility that our country is about to be hitting Iran. We need to do something. And it feels very disempowering right now.
Monica Razi is the executive director of Iranian Alliances Across Borders, and Guy Mufendereski is an attorney in Massachusetts. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that all my friends are dead, and the ones that aren't found recovery.
I think we can't define success as just a decrease in the number of people dying.
I do think that people don't understand what a terrible impact it can have on the whole family.
All this week on the show, we've been hearing reporting out of Ohio on the opioid crisis. Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti spent time on the ground chronicling the challenges of addiction through the stories of 41-year-old Lauren and 25-year-old April. And today in our third installment, how families are impacted when a loved one is addicted, overdoses, and survives.
Lori Arian is angry.
We've had so many tragedies where families have lost loved ones.
Lori is April's mom. We sat down together at the Melody Diner in her home city of Dayton this spring.
There's been initiatives created around that. There's been stories that have popped up about it, and I'm not minimizing that on any level. But I don't hear about families that are trying to keep their loved one alive, that are really in it, buried in it, chaos happening all around, trying to remain sane through it all, help motivate your loved one, help keep yourself healthy. We don't hear about that. And it's brutal.
In late 2013, Lori founded the organization Families of Addicts to provide support to families going through this experience.
One of the first things I hear from families is they feel like they're all alone, like their situation is different. This should have never happened to us, so I don't understand why we're here. So they feel alone. They don't have really any good sounding boards to talk to oftentimes. So when they come to FOA, they're immediately accepted. They're not judged.
And they're understood, Lori tells me, because she knows what this all feels like. Her daughter, 25-year-old April, has battled addiction for nearly a decade. April recently overdosed for the first time and had to be revived with Narcan. Keeping tabs on April's location became a constant obsession for Lori.
We have an app that we use called Life 360. It's an app that she has on her phone and I have on my phone, and it shows location. So for like $7.99 a month, we have this locator. It tells me how many times she's on the phone, whether she's been in a crash, and all this. And so it's just a way for me to know that she's still moving, where she's at, if anything happens, you know, where she's been at. And it really follows her phone as opposed to the car.
April's overdose nearly killed her, and Lori was faced with a difficult choice.
So she called me, and she said that she'd overdose. She was crying that she'd overdose, and could she come home? I said no. And it killed me to do that, but I said no. I said, I don't want to save you here. I can't. I'm not sure I could handle it. I'm not sure if I could handle it. And I don't want to watch you kill yourself anymore. But then as the story unfolded, it turned out that she was in an abandoned house, and she had wanted to leave because she didn't want to do anymore, didn't want to be a part of it, was freaked out, and was going to go somewhere. I didn't feel like that was a good idea. So when I found out those things, lots of conversations and a few criteria later, like you need to call to get back into the treatment center, you need to call your PO, I let her come back.
Lori estimates that she has personally spent between $10,000 and $20,000 in the last few years supporting April. As families struggle through this, there are just not enough resources and support available, she says. Her organization, Families of Addicts, has gotten two small local grants totaling just over $10,000. Those help cover rent for weekly support meetings in two locations. Beyond that, it has received no state or federal funding for its educational programs for families. Across Ohio, she tells me groups focused on the family have been left behind.
One of our members put it this way: it's us helping us. So part of that equation is us helping us doesn't necessarily get you funding. However, it's working. That's the thing. Do we want to fund things that are working or not?
I agree. I mean, I don't think there are a lot of services out there specifically for the families, and not a push for that.
That's Janet Kincaid, mother of 41-year-old Lauren Hamilton from Cleveland.
I'm an attorney, a wife, and a mother, and that's what I do.
Janet remembers the day she first found out about Lauren's opioid addiction, back in 2014, when her daughter missed a family trip.
So when she didn't show up, I got really worried. My husband and I went over to her house. This was about 11 o'clock at night, I guess. And her car was at her house. She wasn't answering, and her dog was barking like crazy. And so we went to the police and asked them to help us break into her house. So they sent a fire truck over, and they broke in through a window upstairs. And then we were standing in the driveway, and they opened up the door from the driveway, and you could see down the basement stairs, and she was kind of sprawled on a couch down in her basement, and she looked like she was dead. So they told us to stay back, and you know, we were just panicking. At least I was. I couldn't believe it. And they brought her up, and I guess they gave her Narcan, and because they had her out front of the house, and we could hear her start shrieking. And then the ambulance came, and they took her to the hospital.
That began a long journey for Janet of trying to keep Lauren alive.
At that point, I this is something I thought you could fix, and I learned really quickly that it's not an easy fix.
You thought sending her to a rehab facility would be a pretty simple fix?
Yeah, yeah. I thought, you know, getting her off the drugs and getting her life back on track would work. I knew so little about this then, and I'm just a fixing kind of person. That's what I do for my clients, and I always think that we can make things better and make things work, and I was helpless with my daughter.
Finding treatment facilities for Lauren, facilities she could afford, even with a stable income, became a major struggle.
It got to the point where, you know, I was pulling money out of my 401k in order to pay for her rehab.
Like Lori, Janet and her family began to desperately track Lauren's movements.
My older son, he actually had a tracking device on her car and maybe in her phone so that he could kind of tell where she was, and he talked to some policemen and some police departments and stuff. He found out about some of her overdoses that way because the tracking, you know, they would show that she was in a hospital.
Janet doesn't think that Lauren ever knew about the devices, and these days she wishes she hadn't known about them either.
As I look back on it, I think it might have been better not to know so much about what she was doing and what was happening with her, because we really couldn't do anything. We were powerless, and so we had this negative information that we really couldn't do much about. Honestly, you know, I was waiting for the call to come to say that she'd overdosed and had not been found in time. I would not have been surprised. I don't want to say I expected it to happen, but I certainly would not have been surprised to get that phone call.
Do you have a sense of how that changed your day-to-day, how that changed your own health or well-being?
I had gone into counseling myself. I went back to church. I had not been attending church for a number of years, but I found that to be helpful. A lot of stress between my current husband and me as a result of this, because of the tremendous costs that we were incurring. And, you know, he believed more in tough love, whereas I was like, I've got to do whatever I can to keep her from dying.
After I spoke with Janet that first time, I got an early morning text message the next day. After talking to you, I've done a lot of remembering of things I have repressed or buried, it read. So I called her back.
After we got off the phone, memories started flooding back. And I think the most difficult one that I remember, you know, Lauren was fighting to break the addiction. She was in unbearable pain. She was feeling hopeless, just wanted to die. I was feeling hopeless and so helpless because I wasn't able to do anything for her. And I remember thinking that we would have all been better off, and especially her, if she had just died during that first overdose, you know, when it was, she was very close to death, because it seemed like this was never ending and nobody should have to go through what she was going through.
Today, Lauren is sober. She's almost hit her one-year mark. And Janet says their family is in a good place.
I'm incredibly proud of her because I've seen her at the lowest when she couldn't beat it and she wanted nothing other than to die.
But back in Dayton, April is still actively battling her addiction. And Lori tells me she struggles with what that means for her.
I'm getting to the end of the line. She just doesn't want to listen to anybody. I'm tired. I've got a little grandbaby from my son. And so there's nothing wrong with saying this next stretch, we've been doing this for 9 years, this next stretch is now about me and my grandbaby and other things. We don't need to feel guilty or bad about that.
For The Takeaway, I'm Alexandra Boti in Dayton, Ohio.
Tomorrow, it's our last installment in Life After Overdose. We return to the women whose stories have driven this series and ask what their futures look like from here. Remember, you can find the whole series at thetakeaway.org/lifeafteroverdose. On Tuesday, as a photograph of migrants Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his 23-month-old daughter Valeria, who drowned in the Rio Grande, began circulating online, the House of Representatives approved a $4.5 billion package for humanitarian aid along the border. But that package appears unlikely to pass in the Senate or to gain the approval of President Trump. At the same time, yet another shakeup at the Department of Homeland Security took place yesterday. After just 2 months on the job, Acting Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection John Sanders has resigned. Sanders will reportedly be replaced by Mark Morgan, former acting head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Here with the latest is Ella Nilsson, a reporter covering congressional news for Vox. Welcome to The Takeaway, Ella.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what's in the aid package that Democrats passed yesterday, and how is it different from a similar measure that has bipartisan support in the Senate?
Right. So the aid package that the House passed yesterday is a $4.5 billion supplemental funding package. And it is really supposed to kind of address this humanitarian problem at the border that we've seen so much outrage about this past week in detention camps, especially when it relates to conditions with overcrowding, these kind of filthy conditions, and especially with children. And there were some last minute tweaks made to this supplemental on Monday and Tuesday after some outcry from progressives in the House. And so now, in addition to the humanitarian funding and the money that's going, there are also going to be these new conditions that require private detention facilities to meet standards of care or risk losing their contract with the federal government. So it's basically sort of trying to put in these teeth to make sure that these facilities are clean, that there are basic needs needs for children and migrants that are being held there. And this is certainly certainly these standards are different than what's in the Senate's package. And I've been hearing Democratic leaders in Congress say that while they think the Senate's package is good, they think theirs is better. So there is certainly going to be some negotiating in the coming days and weeks.
Ella, how likely is it that any aid package will make it to the president? And quite frankly, how likely is it that the president will sign an aid package?
At this point, yesterday, Democrats were notified that the administration had already sort of issued this intent to veto their supplemental, which isn't promising right out of the gate. And certainly, I think that McConnell in the Senate is talking closely to the president and doesn't want the Senate to pass something that the president won't sign. But at the same time, I think Trump must feel the pressure from this sort of growing public outcry about what is happening on the border. There's certainly been a lot of churn in his administration lately on sort of who is leading this. And I think that there are officials that are feeling pressured to deal with this situation. Whether or not the president is one of them remains to be seen.
And of course, we know that there have been shakeups at the very top of the CBP. Who is Mark Morgan and what can we expect from him in what's reportedly going to be his new role as the head of the CBP?
Right. So Mark Morgan was an official who was actually sort of working at the end of the Obama administration. And he was actually he left when the Trump administration took over, was asked to leave. But he is now coming back. Originally, his background is more in the FBI. He actually served under James Comey, I believe, in past years, but now he is sort of coming back and he is definitely sort of seen as more of a hardliner than Sanders, the official who resigned. He is somebody that is in, you know, Stephen Miller's camp. He's somebody that has been on Fox News a lot, kind of saying, touting Trump's sort of more hardline strategy. And as we know, this is a good way to get noticed by the president. So he's now coming back. He's been a big proponent of these sort of mass deportation raids that the president had said he was going to do, but then suddenly backed off from this weekend. So it is a direction that is going sort of more hardline, more of this kind of Stephen Miller wing of the administration.
I'm wondering, and I'm sure I speak for some Americans at least, who are saying how much more harder of a line can we have with this population? I mean, given right. given what we've been seeing, the images that we're seeing, the photograph that we were talking about of the family who'd passed in the Rio Grande, I mean, children without toothpaste and toothbrushes, like what is the harder line at this point?
Right. I think that sort of the distinction between the officials who Trump doesn't see as hardline. I mean, I think these are the officials that are saying, you know, Sanders, there was reporting that Sanders kind of wanted to have more facilities just to cut down on overcrowding and, you know, kind of caution that, you know, that the Trump administration shouldn't go forward with these mass deportation raids. So I think that the people that are hardline are the ones that are saying, Mr. President, you are right to go forward with these raids. And the ones that Trump sort of sees as not following through with his wishes are the ones that are just kind of advocating for these basic humanitarian things at the border, just basic needs for people.
What do we know, Ella, about John Sanders' departure, at least officially from the CBP or unofficially? Because it did happen on the heels of so much public scrutiny and of these images of children who were being held in these detention centers without basic necessities that some folks have even said they haven't had that experience under captured by the Taliban. So was that part of Sanders' departure to decision to leave?
I think it is this rift among officials in the CBP and in DHS of just how far to go. And I think that sort of underlying this is Trump's frustration that people are still coming to the border and wanting officials to stop it. And that is just a reality that they can't do. But until that happens, I think we're just going to see this constant churn, this constant revolving door in DHS and CBP that I think ultimately could make the situation a lot worse.
Ella Nilsson is a reporter covering congressional Democrats for Vox. Thanks for your reporting, Ella.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.